My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the director of Live from the New York Public Library. I am delighted that tonight is the Fall Live season's opening night with Shay Hembree. Stay tuned for our season this fall, which includes evenings with Harry Belafonte, Ariel Dorfman, Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons, Joan Didion, Diane Keaton, Gilberto Gil, Umberto Eco, Jesse Norman, Anish Kapoor, Brian Eno, and many more. When I heard of Shay Hembree's project, his biennial, Seek, which showcases 100 artists from around the world, I simply could not resist. I was reminded of the project of Coma and Melamed, the seriousness and at play, the way in which Shay makes us question what we find of value and what we seek aesthetically as beautiful and rewarding, how the art world lifts us up and mostly lets us down. Shay Hembree grew up in, and now I hope I pronounce this town correctly, in Hickory Grove, Arkansas, in a family of farmers, factory workers, hunters, trappers, musicians, and cockfighters. Though he has developed the majority of his craftsmanship skills on his own, he has a varied formal art education, including an MFA from Cornell University, and a year studying Maori art in New Zealand. His studio is now based in a sleepy town in New Jersey. I like asking our guests what they are reading. Here are the five books Shay is reading right now. Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain by David Eagleman, The Art Instinct by Dennis Dutton, The Golden Bow by James Fraser, Jacobson's Organ and the Remarkable Nature of Smell by Leal Watson, The Gold Cell by Sharon Olds. We ask our guests to provide us with 7-word biographies. Shay Hembree in 7 words. Watches, thinks, makes, stops, then looks again. So now pay attention, stop, think, look again. Ladies and gentlemen, here comes Shay Hembree.
The music was Ima Sumac. I don't know if you're familiar, popular in the 50s, and that's my favorite song to play in the studio when I need to get energized. It's the Gopher Mambo. So the theme for tonight is introducing Shay Hembree, so I'm going to take that as my job. I'm going to introduce you to me, and I'm going to introduce you to the recent project that I finished in the studio. And I'm going to be informal and playful because that's very much who I am. It's great to be here at the library because a library is a place that means a whole lot to me. It's coming from such a rural place. Books is what has made the difference in my life, and it's the path of books has led me from a dirt road in the middle of nowhere in Arkansas to where I am now. When I think of libraries, I always think of probably my favorite library I've ever been in, which was the National Library in Vanuatu, which is an island in the South Pacific, and a set of islands. And I remember going, I was there doing art research for over a week, and I went to the library, and I've never been to a library that had this holiness and this feeling that of reverence. People were standing waiting for a seat and waiting for, you know, a jest to open up. And when they got called, it was like they'd won a gift, which I think is exactly what it should be like when you go to the library. When I started middle school, I had a chance to, I always had art classes when I was in elementary school, and when I started middle school, I had a chance to either take an art class for the first year or to work in the library. I didn't take an art class, and for the next 5 years, I didn't take an art class. I worked in the library for all those 6 years of middle school and high school, and that really says a lot, I think, about who I am as an artist. Research is super important to me, as much as making. And at that library, I made a best friend, and her name was Betty Rowley, and she was a 60-year-old librarian, and I had her for those 6 years, and she made such a difference in my life. And as you can imagine, I was super cool in school because the 60-year-old librarian was my best friend. And also, I carried a briefcase to school, but you know, that was me. I was very serious about school. And so what happened during that hour every day is she really didn't make me work. She let me follow whatever I was curious about and let me do research. And I had that gift for years of just getting to dig in, and I think that's very much formed me as who I am as an artist today. I'm going to get cotton mouth, excuse me. So I think to introduce who I am, I need to launch in some stories about growing up and who and how I grew up and where I grew up. And I'll tell some of my favorite stories that I know friends love. And one of those is when I was five, we had two television channels when I was growing up because it was such a rural space that we had a 30-foot antenna, and if you turned it one way, you got one channel, ABC. If you turned it another way, you got PBS. And when it would start to get winter, we'd have kind of the family meeting and decide, do we want, it would freeze up, so you would have to choose. Is it going to be a winner of PBS or a winner of ABC? And we didn't watch a whole lot of TV anyway, but we did have this discussion of the choice. And the way you would tune the television is someone would stand in the living room, someone would stand at the door of the house, and someone would be out in the yard and by the 30-foot pole with a vice grip, and you'd more, 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 less, 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 until you tuned it in. So when I was five, only thing I really ever remember watching when I was little was documentaries. And I remember when I was five, there was a PBS documentary from the Arkansas local PBS network that was about animals in the Ozarks. And we would spend our summers camping and fishing in the Ozarks. And there was this little fish that I'd never seen before that they introduced, this little sculpin that could change colors. It was camouflage, and it could change colors a bit. And I was so excited because I had never seen one, and it was on the river where we would always to go and spend our summers. And so that was my mission after I saw this, you know, this fish, was to find one. So all that summer when we were there, I was searching for this fish, looking in the moss beds, and finally one day I found them. I found one of these little fish. So for a couple days, I was trying to catch him. I knew which moss bed he lived in, and I was skulking after him. So finally one day I caught him, put him in, you know, like a little plastic camp cup, and I was running around to show him everyone at camp, like, look, it's the fish, it changes colors, and telling him about this fish, and before I could get it back into the water, it died. So I was crying because the fish had died, and it was, you know, the special fish I'd finally found. And my mom said, don't worry, put it on ice. We can take it home, and you can show it to family when we get home. So it goes in the ice chest. It goes home, and it gets put in the freezer. So anyone comes to our house, I'm like, look at my fish. So out of the freezer it comes, and I show them the little frozen fish. But what my family didn't know is when they weren't looking or when it was night and everyone was in bed, I would get the fish out of the freezer and fill up water in the bathtub or the sink and play with him. And I knew how long I could play with him until he started to get really, like, kind of gooey. Like, he felt like uncooked steak. And then he'd have to go back in the freezer. So he had these two little indentions where I would always just play with him. And so I had him for years. I played with him for years. And then getting older, I remember coming home from high school one day and there being food everywhere and walking in the house, and Mom said, don't freak out. The refrigerator died, but the fish is at your grandmother's. It's in her freezer. And so the fish went through a couple freezers, and it finally got buried when I went off to New Zealand because I was going to be leaving the country. And now I'm really sad that the fish was buried. And, you know, its fins was missing. It was really pretty completely fallen apart. And he became like the mascot of our freezer. Every time you opened it there, he would be there. And there's a picture of me at five. And my sister got a new puppy. And that lump in my hand is my frozen fish. And I'm happier than she is, I think. Don't you love the shag carpet? My sister's so tough. I love these horrible high cutoffs and her suspenders because she's so stylish now. It's so funny. And also that same year, another story who would, friends and family would point out who say a lot of who I am is I remember walking on the side of the road and in the dirt, and you know, they would grate the road and there would be like berms of sand along the road, and there was this perfect little egg sitting on the side of the road, and I remember picking it up. It wasn't cracked, and it had fallen from the nest in the tree above, and I knew it was a turtle dove because my dad told me. And I remember listening to it and holding and looking at it and telling them, this is going to hatch. And my parents, because they're the kind of parents who let you keep a dead fish, let me try to hatch it. And so I wrapped it in a washcloth. It went everywhere with me. And then at night, it got put on the lamp, my bedside lamp. And after 3 days, it hatched. And they were all completely shocked. And I wasn't shocked because I could tell there was, you know, there was life in there. The sad part of that, I didn't know how to, none of us really knew how to take care of a baby. Now I could take care of a baby bird if I hatched it out. But at that point, I didn't know enough how to take care of a baby bird. So now let's go to six, and I'll tell you some stories from when I was six. No, I'm kidding. I'm not going to. We'll skip along a little bit. I can ramble on endlessly about my childhood, though, because it is really quirky. I never even thought of it as quirky until you move away and then you realize that was really strange. So I've been working as an adult artist for like 20 years now. And for sure the hardest was the first 5 years because it was really, I remember thinking all the time, what can I do that's new? What can I do that's new? And that was what I was really focused on, trying to figure out how to do something important and new. And then I remember one day meeting with a professor and having this discussion that really changed things. And it was the idea that what would you make if no one could see it? What if you had to work in the studio for 2 or 3 years, no one would ever see it? What would you choose to do? So what would that look like? And I remember thinking about that and thinking, if I figure that out, then I know I have my voice. Because it's the labor that you have to do. It doesn't matter if it ever gets any attention. And from that point on, I remember just having such a kind of a discovery of voice and just such a relaxation about no pressure anymore. Just do what, follow the question, follow the research, follow the passion. And that, I don't know, that peace and freedom has continued, and it's amazing how just not questioning your voice and owning it so prepares you to ask the big questions. So I'm amazed by the power of art. I love, and I'm often surprised by the power of art, and I'm also sometimes frightened by the power that art has over me. A really good work of art, I can't hardly even look at it. Today, Vicky just showed a wonderful piece. We were looking at things in the special collections, and as soon as she showed, I just turned around because I can't, you know, like it's just too powerful. Hold on, you know, let me prepare myself. Let me brace myself. And that's something I'm always hoping that's going to happen when you go to a museum, that something's going to really hit you and that you have to look away or that you have to sit down. And I always call those conversion experiences where you become a believer in this work when it gets you. And a couple of those, I'm always hoping these are going to happen. I hope they're going to, there will be a surprise. That's the great thing about going to museums, not knowing if there's going to be this great conversion experience today. I know I'm going to find things I enjoy, but is there going to be a work that overpowers me? I remember being in Sydney over 10 years ago and seeing this large Cezanne exhibition, and there being one still life painting that was in the show that I walked through, and then I went back, and then I walked through, and I went back, and I walked through, and went back, and that was that morning. And I stood there in front of it all day until the security guards repeatedly asked me to leave. So I spent all day in front of this painting. I just physically couldn't make myself move on. And I was trying to figure out what is going on in this painting? Why can't you even walk away from it? And I don't even know if I can explain it well, but the best way that I can try to talk about it is that the paint wasn't paint. It had the energy and the speed of human flesh. It was as if it was alive. And I remember thinking, okay, I'm tripping out because I'm not seeing paint. I'm seeing flesh. And why am I seeing that? And then I'm thinking, well, you know, when you paint skin, it does become salt and peppered with your DNA. You know, I'm sensing that maybe. And so eventually security guards asked me to leave. And then I'm relieved because I have to leave Sydney and I'm not going to have to go spend tomorrow standing in front of this painting. So those wonderful overcoming moments, I never can fully figure them out. And I think that's why I love art. I'm always wanting to find this. And I always want to provide this for someone else. And how do you do that? And it's it's sometimes frightening when you think of, I remember being in Fairbanks and seeing these Inuit stones in a case and running to the bathroom and locking myself in and saying, don't try to break them out, because I just remember looking at them and thinking they need to be outside. They need to be in the elements. They don't have their power because they're not out in the elements. And you're like, well, that seems totally ridiculous. But, okay, don't get out of the bathroom stall. Stay locked in here until you talk yourself down, because you can't break them free. Because no one's going to believe you. How's that going to? Oh, they needed to be freed. But they did need to be freed. So finally, I just had to rush from the bathroom out of the museum. It's like, you know, don't try to free it. And I'm always waiting to find myself in super trouble. In China a couple years ago, I remember having this experience with an object again and thinking, what's the worst case scenario if they arrest you? You're trying to break this piece free. You get put in a Chinese prison, you know. You'll learn Chinese. It'll be a good experience. You know, the worst thing that can happen. And so when I hear stories of people taking knives to canvases or hammers to sculptures, I always think, wow, someone was enchanted and they were trying to break that enchantment. So hopefully it never happens to me that I get arrested. So before I should probably talk about my recent project before I just keep going on and on. So a few years ago, I was in Europe going to see all the big biennials and other shows like Documenta that were giving a survey of contemporary art now. And they all happened to line up in this year in 2007. And I didn't expect to, you know, always find works that's going to make me want to, you know, go to prison for it. But I expect to find works that I find interesting. And I expect to find works that, you know, have these ideas that intrigue me and that I feel the passion in the work and that have staggering technique. So I'd been going and seeing these for months, and I was painting in Europe as well. And so the last one that I was to go and see was in Venice, the Venice Biennale. So I had over a week to see it, slowly taking time, because it takes time to see work properly. I always think the best way to see work is, not that anyone needs instruction how to see work, but if you can make yourself stand for at least a minute and just empty yourself out and not try to think, just stand there and say, I'm in front of you. If you can reveal yourself, I'm here for a minute, and then I'm going to start thinking and evaluating what you are as an object in front of me. So I'm in Venice and excited about this Biennale. Hopefully it's going to be the one that's going to beat all the others, because I've been hoping for more in all the others and wanting more, just wanting to feel more and get blown away and waiting to be blown away. So I got up the morning that I was going to spend my first full day at the Biennale, and I get on the Vaporetto and take the water taxi, and it's time to get out, and I can't bring myself to get off and go in the venue. And I thought, oh, I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready to be let down, or maybe I'm not ready to be so surprised. So I just remember thinking, it's not fair that I can say I'm not pleased if I can't put it into words. So that day, I just started making notes, and I spent the entire day riding water taxis. And I never went in the venue that day. And I filled just scraps and scraps of every piece of paper I could get my hand on. That whole day I wrote feverishly about what I wanted to see in a biennial, what I wanted to see in contemporary art that I hadn't been seeing or what I wanted to see more of. And that night, I remember going back to the hotel room and just there's being a mountain of paper on the bed and looking at it and thinking, what the hell am I going to do with this pile? With all this idea and all this, like, I've mapped out this thing that I want. So what am I going to do with it? And I remember putting it in Ziploc bags and hiding it at the bottom of my suitcase. But of course, it gnawed on me, and I was thinking, I'm gonna have to curate my own biennial, and I'm gonna have to figure out how to do that, and I'm gonna have to start. And then one day, I realized, you know, that I'm a maker, I'm not a curator, so I should just make it. And I remember thinking, that's a ridiculous, audacious thought, because you need lots of artists to make a biennial. And then I realized, well, I could become all those artists. So that was the initial idea that drove me crazy. It was the sand in my shell. And so I started to think about it, started making notes, and I decided it should be done in 2 years because it should be a true biennial in that way. And so I started to work, and I did it in 2 years. It ended up being 106 artists, and there are two fictional curators as well. And I decided to make it in secret. I had enough voices in my head. I didn't need other people talking about it, and there's something also really powerful about feeding it, knowing that I was doing something secret that was big. And the result is a book. It's this biennial catalog, which is a 412-page documentation of this of my biennial. And it was also fun to really, gosh, to be so many different people. And I would never choose to work as someone else. I love to work as me, so it was really weird to get this idea and then have the challenge of working as other people. And that's been super educating, and I can talk a little bit more about that later. And how do I put myself in there? How is it me, but all, you know, through the filter of all these other people? So I should start introducing you to some of these guys. Okay, this is French conceptual artist Sebastian Roux, and he's very interested in collections, and he's admittedly an incurable collector. And so what he presents in this biennial are two of his collections, and he's really wanting to get across focusing on what's missing from his collection, focusing on that drive to collect. So here he presents his box collection, which is entitled 12.14 cubic meters of emptiness, and it's measured by what isn't there, the empty space in the boxes, so that the more boxes he adds to his collection, the larger the emptiness. The other collection that he shows is a vessel collection, and it's measured by the volume of water that is held, and water is dripping and overflowing, and it's this, the echo is, the sound is like the dripping tap in the night that keeps you calling, wanting to collect and wanting to make more and more and more. The next artist is, she's referred locally as the Sleek Walkin' Mama. She's a housewife in Memphis. Her name's Audrey Keach, and she's a stay-at-home mom, and she makes work when she's asleep, and she's as surprised by what she makes as her family is. So she describes what she makes as protective talismans for her, that protect her family. So one morning they woke up and she had painted this protective like pattern around the house. This was at the foot of one of her daughter's bed. It's made out of Kool-Aid mix and glitter. And then she sewed her twins together one night, which she says she's most surprised when she sews because she's never sewed before, but sometimes she sews at night. The next artist is a Spaniard, Bartholomew Soto. I should say something about names. When that was a great thing, is getting to name all these many, many people. And I knew I wanted a lot of the names, to honor friends and family that I grew up with. And so I started to first start with naming. I got my family tree out, and then I got out a piece of paper and I sat down and I thought, I'm going to write down all the neighbors who have all the farms around us growing up. So I started writing down the neighbors' names. Rudolph Pretty, Corny Waters, Frog Heath, Dolphus Davenport, Red Payne. And I thought, okay, these names are ridiculous. You know, like, okay, I can't use the names of the real, you know. So that gave me great permission to name however I wanted to, because it couldn't be as wild as what I had grown up with. And so Bartholomew Soto, he's very much like me in the sense that he's interested in the power that vision has on you to make you do unreasonable things. So he's playing with the idea of like the Medusa, not looking at Medusa, but you'd be turned, or turning back to be turned to a pillar of salt. So he's referencing this in this a series that he does called Sacred Relics. And to see these works, you can't look at them directly. You only look at the mirror reflection of the object in the exhibition because it's too powerful to be looked at directly. This piece is, these are the eyes of Clovis, and they are pupils from ancient statues of deities. So he's totally, absolutely made up all these fake relics. This is the Fetus of Ephesus, another thing you can't look at directly. This is a Michigan artist, Fadi Humad. He grew up always hearing his grandmother talking about wanting to go back to Mecca. And so when she was ailing, he decided to do this as a gift to her. And in the woods, he did this giant infinity shape of a path in the woods that he entitled Towards Iram for her. Because she would always say, you know, I want to go back to Mecca, but my health isn't enough, but Allah is everywhere. So this was a gift that he made for her. And what I like about this piece is the getting down on the knees and crawling through the forest and experiencing nature in such a different way by that softness and by being on that level. Next is a Kiwi artist who's now living in San Diego, Kiri Robbins. And so when the curators went to visit with her, they went to visit with her about her sculpture, but they noticed that she had notes all over her arms. And they started asking her about them, and she explained that she was starting to suffer from memory loss, as her mother had. And so she was worried, but she was convinced that maybe she could help stave off all this memory loss by things, by what she was calling preventative measures, doing these creative things that that would help her not lose her memory by using making again and again as a way of keeping a memory. So she made a set of flashcards, and she's remaking the set each week, and the objects tell the story of her life. And that's the pile of flashcards. Oliver's asking questions. and that's another, that's one image from her flashcards. That's an image of a ring. So next is Juhu. He's a performance artist and an artist who does a lot of installations, and he's interested with altering timelines and playing with time. And for this project, which is called Grove, he camps out for a month in a small set of woods and tries to maintain that this is in fall, and he tries to maintain the woods to the exact moment it was that he showed up. So as leaves fall, he tapes them back on the trees. If he runs into a stone, he tries to tape it back into where it was in position. So he spends this month trying to maintain this stasis. This is funny. I remember Sandy's laughing. She remembers helping me the day we did this. This is Amanda Payne, and she's worked for years with Myth and Legend. And for this recent project, which she calls Monstrous, she's creating evidence for fictional creatures. And she doesn't document it. She creates them where she thinks people run across it. And because she really loves to keep the mystery going alive of things like Sasquatch. And so in this one, in the next image, she dresses up in a costume and finds trails where hunters have set up game cameras to photograph game moving by, and she triggers them. And so she's always looking on websites, UFO websites and monster sighting websites, to see if her work got discovered by anyone. This is a footprint of the New Jersey Devil. This is an image from Hetty Holden. She's she does all these projects where she knows there's going to be a failure, but she's trying to communicate with other species. And this one, this is a diagram of the ultimate and the eight the ultimate and eight diagrams, a Chinese symbol. And so she does these drawings and puts them in hives to communicate with the bees. And so this one is a this one is, what's it called? A hexagon, the comb for the larva. So she puts them in, and then the bees chew them up and spit them out, shred the works. Next is Esther Bergen. Esther Bergen in the 60s lost her son and husband in an accident, and she started making these books about them. And that led to her making books about all the friends and family in her community and the congregation in her community. So when she passed away last year, they found these piles and piles of books that have, after looking through her diaries, they're finally starting to decode them. And she calls all her symbology, she calls a soul language. And they're drawn upon patterns from her garden and quilting patterns. The two curators here are trying to demystify some of her soul language. That, by the way, is my grandmother. And that's a map from one of the books. The next artist is Ed Fortune, and he's a performance artist, and he's really interested in playing trickster and pushing it to the edge. And in this project, which is called Too Big to Succeed, he what he does is push something so beyond the boundaries that the only thing responsible is to make it fail. So he started a church called the True Word Church of Christ, and he started getting Bibles and whiting out everything except for the red letters, which are the words of Christ. So for him, the big challenge is, when do you stop? How far do you push this? And well, he discovered he'd pushed it too far when he goes to his small congregation and they take him and surprise him as they are starting to build a mother church. So then he has to do this whole backtrack and explain that it's an art project. I see you. This is from Hilda Singh's Social Outfits project, and she wanted to make these things that people could wear that would create thoughtful social interactions. This is a Seeing the World Through Others' Eyes helmet. The next one is Spreading One's Point of View hat, and the next one is a personal space ensuring device. It has all these prongs where you can only get so close or you run into her. And this was in China, and I had my friend Catherine put it on, and this was one of the greatest moments of this whole project. She put this on, and we started walking down the street, and these two women started screaming and running, and it was two women who cleaned the streets, and they had vests, glow-in-the-dark vests, but they weren't decorated like that. And so they were all over this garment and asking tons of questions, which me and her totally didn't we had no clue what was going on. But they were so enthusiastic, and I said, oh, we'll go back next year and they'll have embroidered all their their work gear. This is also in China. So this was a fun part of this project, is getting friends and family to be tons of different characters. And I had to be tons of different characters in front of the camera besides making the work. I was dressed as a 19th century explorer and going around China with my height and with those clothes. It was a lot of attention. This is me as a drag queen, another artist, a Tibetan artist who now lives in Brooklyn. This is another great memory of making the whole biennial. This was this large cube that I had put in a friend's industrial freezer so that the air would be refrigerated and it would be foggy, so that I could rush it into the woods and take the photo and it would have the correct atmosphere. So I have this huge box, and I'm running through the woods before it, you know, the refrigeration will cool off to get it in sight where I had found in this moss bed where I wanted to take the photos. But you had to cross a river, and the day before I had been, and the river was low. I got down there, and I have my box and my friends behind me with all the photo equipment, and I'm carrying this big box, and which is kind of a ridiculous thing to lug through the woods, is this box of air that's refrigerated. So she's behind me with all the photo equipment. We get there, and the river is raging, and there's kayakers. And I have to get to the other side because this is where I'm going to take the photographs. And I was like, I think I can make it. And so I take off, and I have the box, and I get like halfway through, and I get knocked down because of the pressure, and off I go. And there goes the box, and I see it go over the fall, and I'm thinking, do you go over the fall? Or do you let the air, refrigerated air, go? And I didn't really think. I went over the fall. And then I went over the fall and underwater and come up, and I didn't hit my head, and I pop up around all these kayakers who were just like gobsmacked. And I just start laughing because, you know, there's this box. So I grab it, and I'm walking out, and I'm thinking I should turn around and ask one of them, will you sign for this package, sir? You know? So I pick up the box in and go, and the moss bed that I thought would still be there had flooded, and I thought, this was really, what an idiot am I? So I have to get back across, so the long and short of it is I take the photo elsewhere, and the fog disappeared that was inside it, but the mist from this waterfall made a great image anyway. That's a long and rambling story just to say I do really ridiculous things, like carry boxes of refrigerated air through the woods, but it makes total logic sense to begin with. Maybe not while you're doing it. This is from Naya Jayasuriya. She's a Sri Lankan artist, and she wrote the longest epic that has ever been written. It's called Sunder. And then she decided that she was going to make animations of it. This is from the first portion of animations. This is Grior. He is one of the main characters. And it all unfolds in the contents of a cast-off subtle bottle. And it's the long fins and the wash rags battle out, do this battle to control sunlight. This is from a British artist that's now living in Amsterdam, Jolanda Patel, and her project is called The Hidden Body of Air, and this is a buoy that she uses to let you know what's going on in the space, because a lot of it has to do with humidity and smoke, and you have to look at the objects that are suspended to understand what's the movements. Next is Zora Moretti. She's in Spain now, and this is from a group of work that she calls Finishing in Others, and she found this trove of unfinished canvases. They were canvases that were just gessoed with drawings on them by this Bulgarian artist, and she made it her mission over a decade to somehow finish the works, though she realized she never could. So these works are really about that discussion of trying to finish someone else's work. Next is Ana Rosa Borrego, and she's interested in hidden views. For one whole set of works, she does portions of the backs of famous masterpieces. And in this piece, it's from a series of what you see when your eyes are closed. This is from Jerky Petraskis. He's a Lithuanian artist known as the Seer of Trakai. He calls them appeals, but really they're prayers that people come to him and have make. And he refers to them as hope sent outside your body. Next is by a collective of fathers from Omaha, Nebraska, and they call themselves FAGS, which stands for Fathers of Active Gay Sons. And they began making these crafty objects that would embrace their son's life, every aspect of their son's life. And this is a memento mori cum rag. Next is by a Belgian artist, and he is interested in, he believes that there is a logic that is, he sees these moments of logic unfolding in nature, that he can't read them, but he knows when to capture them. So this is a whole series of photographs where he's trying to capture this coded logic. this image is from Clayton and McGee. There's these two best friends who met each other in Southern California, retired CEOs who became friends and on a whim one day decided to start making graffiti. And this is one of them's tags, and it's he calls his tag the Killer Martini. This is another Southern California artist, Dustin Turner, and he calls what he does artifications, and he uses art as, he says it's his best form of currency. And after spending a day running around Southern California with a shopping cart, it's like really great. I was like, every time I'm in the city now, I think, I need a shopping cart. This is like the best way to get around and carry all your stuff. This is from Tucker Davenport, and he is a savant who counts colors, and these are diaries of his week where he chronicles the colors of each day. Next is Xavier Reed. He's a French artist who he makes machines that try to right our humanity, try to correct our emotions or fix our unreasonableness. This one, you can see the title here. Some of his others include a favorite child equalizing machine, a de-baptism vice, and an inheritance calculator. This is from Chloe Papineau, a South African artist, and this is a piece from a whole series she did when she was battling cancer. This is a game board from a performance piece from Imogene Dupree, an artist in her 70s, and this is so fun because I always want to play it. And one of the things I'll point out is these are raccoon penis bones, which in the South are for good luck. Like, so if you go to a casino, you'd put one in your pocket. So I thought it was fun to have a game where you play with raccoon penis bones. This is from Nina Schaffner. Maybe I shouldn't say much more about Nina Schaffner's work. this is from Azaz Rezazadeh, an Iranian artist, and this is from a memorial she did to the Iran-Iraq War. This is from Fred Salinger's work, and this is from an essay he did with images called Art That Isn't, and he was attempting to make these zero-stimulus pieces. Next is from a Chilean artist, Claudia Sands, and this is from a large dowry installation of hers, and this is the Hall of Textiles in that installation. Next is it's from a group of artists. Winston B. Davis started this project, and he started hiring migrant workers to help him on some projects, and then he decided to just start paying them to make whatever they wanted to make, and he would give them a topic. And so the topic for what is included in this biennial is, how did you get to this country? And this is from Al Sepulveda, one of the migrant workers who painted for him. This is from Choctaw Riley's, a series of short films that he calls filmed haikus. This is... I hear Sandy laughing again. This is from Carla Newton, a British artist, and it's called Partial Vacuum, and it's a short film about how we instinctively protect what we believe in, even if we haven't analyzed our beliefs. And this is actually shot across the river, where me and Michael and Sandy all kayaked out, and it's all these little islands. And the fun part of shooting that was just having Michael and Sandy, who are married, yell at each other for a couple hours. And I was like, oh, throw stones now. So it was really great to watch them play that out. This is from Lucy Tran, a Texan artist who grew up in her mother's salon. And she did these paintings out of fingernail polish that are about personal adornment. And each one is of different clients, regulars at the salon. This is from a New York artist, Danny Kravitz. And... these are heaps of silver ash, and this is a memorial that he did to his Polish grandmother. This is from Violet Waters, and she is a sculptor who always buries her work, and this is a large group of conceptual pieces about the power of burial. This is from a photographer who did these sets of portraits of workers in a Rust Belt aluminum factory. And this piece is from Jabez Beatty, and I remember my sister seeing this for the first time and started laughing so hard. And she recognized why the artist's name was Jabez Beatty. So there's all these carvings of vulvas. And growing up, my doctor until I was in my 20s was the local gynecologist because my aunt worked for him. And his name is Jabez. So when she saw that I had named him Jabez, she's laughing so hard. And she's like, no one will ever know how funny that all these, how funny that is that you used his name. This is from Rosalie Starr. She actually died in the 60s, but all this work was recently found. She was a librarian at a local black college in Georgia. This is from Inez Wu. She did a whole series called The Never Portraits, Portraits of Extinct Species. This is another portrait, series of portraits, and from Nate Gann, and he's trying to make portraits of something ephemeral as a river. So he's making these river portraits, and he's using metal and embossing them to this one single instance of the flow of the river. This is, I always laugh because it's Boomer Bazemore. That name is always so funny. Boomer Bazemore is playing with ancient Roman ways of reading the haruspices and augurs to playing with pop culture by using ancient Roman divining techniques, like in this one, using reading entrails. And in this case, the entrails don't tell you anything except that you need to refer to an augur to see what a bird will tell you. And this is from Clyde Hunter, a Canadian artist, and he uses inspiration as his studio subject. And this is a group of sculpture called Muses. This is from Olin Burgess. He's a monk who left the order, and he said he had to leave the order when he couldn't talk to a fellow brother without wanting to lick his nipples. And this piece is called, I love the title of this one, Suckle, Nipples of Adam, Nipples of Jesus, upon which we could suckle yet not be fed. Next is Maddie Thompson, and she's been doing a whole series for a few years. This is about her virtual life, and does it have more reality, the online life that she lives, than her real lived reality? And then this is Janine Jackson, an Australian artist, and this is work. This is a crate that was shipped to a museum, and when they opened it up, the work had reworked itself. It had cocooned itself into become something else. It's funny because Janine Jackson, I was really careful when I named everyone to do research that I had not actually used the name of a real artist that was out there working, so I did web searches for every name. So I get an email about a month ago from Janine Jackson, an Australian artist, and she says, I'm a Janine Jackson. I saw this talk online that you did, and I'm an artist, and my name is Janine, and I live in Melbourne. She's like, what can you tell me about me? So I sent her her bio, and I sent her images and text about her work, and she wrote back to say that, well, actually, I'm also from Melbourne, Australia. Such a moving letter back saying that she had stopped working for years and she was going to start working again. And to say thank you. And she was in a wonderful line, I wonder what other people you've secretly reawakened into doing the lives they should have lived. Okay, I think I'm going to quit rambling. That's not quite half, but it gets tedious, I think, because it's especially showing just a few images. But I can field questions if people are up for questions. Okay.
What came first in most of these? The art or the artist?
That's a really good question. It varied, and I didn't want it to become too formulaic. Michael asked what came first, the artist or the work. Sometimes the work came first, and I had to figure out who would make that and why would they make that and the whole life of it. Sometimes it was the the artist, and I had to figure out what would be important that they say. And I would never set out, it's weird to work as other artists, because I wouldn't set out to work as other artists, but to make this work, I had to work as other artists. So every single time it was different. Sometimes I knew so much about the person and I could never figure out what the hell do they make, you know, like, are they ever going to, they had, you know, there's the struggle, is their work going to involve the struggle they're having in their lives, or, and that's really, really, really educating. I think a great MFA program would be 1 year where the students have to work not as themselves, but as someone else, because it really makes you think about what you naturally do. And sometimes I would start to make something and I realize, no, I'm totally doing what I would do. And then I'd stop and ask myself, what's the complete opposite I would do? And then, okay, but I wouldn't do that. How can you do that? And it makes some kind of logic, and you believe in it and get behind it. And if you can figure out the opposite of what you do, but also that you can believe in it and you see the value in it, it's really, really educating and enlightening. Ernie.
I think about 4 or 5 images back, you had a Roman piece or a figure against a wall, and I wanted to ask, what type of material did you use?
Can I go back? Yeah, when we get to it.
There you go.
This one?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's actually, instead of using really real guts and then photographing it, it's all sculpture. It's sculpy, and then everything's painted and then coated in pigment. And it's actually, I don't know where it is. I hid it because it kind of grossed me out. Because it was sitting in the studio, and it's all glistening because I coated in all these levels of blood and fluids, of shiny fluids. But it's pretty much plain old sculpy.
Did you have to fire any artists or destroy any work?
Yeah, well, I did 106, and 6 of them didn't make the final cut. and it was weird. I kept coming. One thing that you also really learn from doing this many artists is how you keep doing the same thing over and over again. You have a certain way of working that you, like, okay, this is how you go about it. And I kept trying to be the same artist over and over again. I was like, okay, I'm not allowed. This is, no one can deal with this. And then you'd have to go somewhere else. I want to show the 6 others at some point. Some of it's too naughty. and then even I was like, oh, I can't believe I did that. So, and I didn't want the shock value to take over the value of, like, it being really important work. Yeah.
Do you feel a need to continue the body of work of any of these artists? And if so, would you consider it yours or theirs? Yeah.
It's weird. When I finish it, once the work is done, they feel like a real person to me, and then I'm done with them. And when I talk, I notice when I finish them, I talk about them as if they're real. But the point of building them, and then during the work, you know, it's, I don't talk of them as, you know, as a different person. Some of it, I want to, just because it was so much fun, because I got to try on paths I never went down as an artist, and it was just the materiality or, but I think a different thing to do would be maybe do portraits of the 100 artists, do a whole series of portraits that show what their faces are, because I have in my mind's eye, that's a whole other level, their lives and their stories and what they look like and sound like. We'll see. Some of it I won't be able to resist, even if it never sees the light of day, just because it's so much fun, some of the work. And it's such an antithetical to what I maybe would normally do.
I'm interested in that idea of the national character of your artist.
A national character?
Yeah,
the nationality?
Like, were there any countries that you just couldn't get into?
Well, you know? that was a big challenge, because who am I to be able to make African work? And who am I to make, you know... But it's a big fiction, so you had to give myself permission. So much of the time I was like, oh, this dude's Southern again, you know, like, and I had, okay, no, I had to totally re-envision it before I started working. And I noticed the other day, writing their ages down, they're all so many of them are my age or older. And so it's, yeah. The nationality, I don't, some of it, I mean, because of the work, it would have to be that. The whole thing, the whole great thing about Americans or Canadians, it could be anything, you know, like it, that was like really, really easy. And kind of I just didn't deal with it in a way by giving the next year's biennial. The next year, the curators are going to change, and it's going to be set in Africa, and they're going to pull from a different geographic area. So this could be much more strongly based in Europe and in North America. So that's, in a way, how I got around a lot of it, because I couldn't bring myself to feel like I had permission a lot of the times to do some of the work. And then I lived in Australia for a while. I mean, I lived in New Zealand for a while, and spent a lot of time in going to museums in Australia. And so I felt, had a sense of like pockets of places. I spent a month in Chile, so I feel like I had a sense of the art there. So a lot of them are based on places I've been. So I felt like I could, like I spent time in Lithuania, so I was like, oh, I can do a Lithuanian artist. So that's one thing. I kind of ticked down wherever I'd been and worked nationally that way. But the world is so connected now that it's, yeah. Yeah.
Did you, this is a two-part question.
Okay.
Did you find that the artists were jealous of each other and vying for more space in the studio or more days, or did you feel more loyal to certain artists than others? And the second part of that question is, how did it feel having so many artists renting space in your head?
Yeah.
Like,
good question.
Like,
yeah,
like
yeah.
Did they, were you tempted to make the same work? Like, were they copying from each other?
Yeah, good questions. It's funny, I was thinking what a fun thing to do would be to open a Twitter account for each one of them and let them all fight it out. Let them argue about issues, and the way I had to work with them, I could only have three or four in a head at a time or it would drive me crazy. So I'd be working on a set, and when they were done, I just kind of removed them and boxed them and put them away so they weren't in the studio, and that work did just disappear. So there'd be three or four that I was trying to work on, and I tried to have them be different from each other because you could get them confused. And I would not make... I would do prep work for one, but I wouldn't really put myself... I like really give myself for... That week, I was really putting myself as this person, you know. And I, mindless prep work of underpainting or something, I could do why this dried, you know. I could go into another room. But I tried to really do 1 week at a time. Did I answer that halfway? I missed, I don't know if, he had a lot of good questions, really, more than one. No, there were times, I told Liz, I was like, if I start to go crazy, please let me know because, like, there's so many voices in my head. And especially when they're antithetical to each other, you know. But I do have favorites. And I have, I don't know what this says, but my favorites are the ones that are the most opposite of me and the ones that are basically me. Maybe we should just have done questions. I feel like I did a really bad slideshow. We're getting much more ground here.
I also have a two-part question. So one is, if and when you go back to making work as yourself again,
yeah,
how do you think this will affect that? Should I just ask that question first?
Yeah, okay. Well, the next project that I'm thinking about a lot, I think it's got to be a bridge project because to wean me back to, because, and it's going to be a project based on family history and a lot of family voices and giving them voice and working in a way as them and telling their story. So that's going to be a bit of a bridge. Because it's kind of weird to go and sit in the studio now and it's just you, you know.
And then the
you
other
can't blame anyone that they, you know, they were having a bad day.
The other question I had is, I'm wondering if you found yourself having a formula as you came up with ideas for the different artists projects, and did you have to push yourself to break out of that so that you weren't falling into that pattern?
Yeah, because I noticed that really fast within the first five artists that it becoming formulaic, because this is the person, and then you figure out who they are, and then this is what they'd make, and this is how they'd go about it. And that's where coming in, like starting with the work first and then working backwards, helped change it. And then trying to shake that as much as possible so it didn't become formulaic. Because there was a routine that it was like, I guess, writing fiction, that, you know, you figure the person out, but what if you figure it out, instead of the character first, you figure it out the very last thing they do in the last scene, and then you work back, so. Or if you jump in the middle and then work both ways, so. It came about all kinds of ways. Sometimes it was a material, and I just set myself up the challenge of, like, this material is going to be one of the artists, you know, this roll of lead, so I have to figure that out. And that helped break the formula of, like, yeah.
I was wondering when the curators started to become clear.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Because I noticed that some of your artists were very studied. They were art students, they were artists, and then others were what we would call, like, an outsider.
Right,
you know,
right.
And also kind of what the percentage of each was.
Yeah, I'm really wild about people who would never get found, and that was a really great thing about getting to play curator, because you can make all these secret people up who would be really difficult to find, because if I curated this, I would never find, you know, like, a lot of this work, and there's a lot of that in there, and I'm excited about that work, and I always think, how on earth is it found? That's why I included some things that was found, that was from the 60s, you know. I got to go back to the first of the question, which was... What was the first?
I was wondering when the curator's voices.
When I give myself permission to just go to 50, and then from 50 on to really start bringing their voices out, and then I started making notes, and then they really started to curate after I had 50 on, because I, like, didn't want to slow the pace. And when I knew I had half, then it was like I gave myself permission to be the weird critic, which is so weird to work at the same time as curating, because, like, no, you can't make this because it's not going to make the cut because we've got this guy who does it better, and it's already going to be, you know. Or you're like, oh, maybe I do it, and then it gets put in, and he became one of the six that didn't make it in. The curators is it's interesting. I wanted it to be a man and woman that kind of fight, because it was kind of the voice I had in my head all the time, like, do I include this? Do I not? Do I? You know, like, so that has a banter going on. And if you read the catalog, they have a voice. Like, it's hard. I don't bring that across the way the catalog does, which was really interesting to write as them. The best part of writing the catalog was to, like, get to a point where you need to give the artist a quote, and you could come up with whatever perfect quote you needed. Oh, it was so great. Yeah. Does that answer? A lot of these things are, I think it's going to take me years to think about, because it's such a weird way of working. I mean, who would choose to play curator and 100 artists? It gets complicated, and I probably don't even fully understand it. The more I think about it and reflect on it, the more I feel like I understand it.
You started your talk by talking about how passionately you look at art.
Yeah.
Do you find that the way you look at art now has changed?
I want to fix it for people. Lately I noticed that I see it and I think, oh, they're one of my fictional people, and if I just tweak this little bit and do this little bit, then it's better and it can go in the catalog. So it's weird, yeah. And I think I'll have that for a while, which is not good, I think, because it's going to take a while to really enjoy. I mean, I enjoy work whether it's good or bad, because if it's bad, I'm like, oh, it makes me really want to work, you know, and get out there and make work. And if it's really good, then it's just so inspiring. But yeah, I think that would be the difference. Vicky has a question? Uh-oh.
I have to say, looking at the catalog now, when I go to art exhibits, I feel like, wow, that's really a Shea project, you know, so it will affect that way. But you started out by talking about your family a little bit, and I know from looking at the catalog and talking to you a bit that your family has been really supportive of, and you use them in various projects and
right.
And so forth. And your friend Liz, who's here, I hope this isn't too personal, but she told me a wonderful story about your family doing a kind of a memorial in your neck of the woods in Arkansas about Japanese the work. I wonder, would you mind telling about that project? This was a family project?
No, it wasn't. They all helped construct it. The great thing about my family, I never tell them they didn't know, this was a secret, and they didn't know what I was doing, and they just knew it changed a lot. And I said, it'll make sense in the end. And they always would just chip in and help. And, you know, they go to the graveyard and dance without really understanding why. So they've been around me enough years to know that I have a logic for it. And then later they'll understand. The project that I did was, there were lots of, that you're referring to was there were lots of internment camps during the Second World War for Japanese Americans that they took them to Arkansas. And I did this large piece in a field, which was like tons of kimonos on giant poles, and my family had to be the laborers for that. And they flexed and moved, and they looked like they were flying. I don't know. Was there something else about that that you? Yeah, to do something. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't thought about that piece. And when you first said it and you were saying it, I was thinking, who's the Japanese artist that did kimonos? Because I don't remember. Did they make it in? No, they're always really, my family's really, really. It's actually amazing that they always do such. And they're such good laborers. That's the thing. Everyone, you know, they know how to use their hands. That's the way I grew up. You know, like everyone learns how to sew and to cook and, you know, work with metal and carpentry. Everyone has those skills, so it's great to have those people as a slave labor force. And my friends that I make help.
Maybe a three-part question.
Oh, no.
How do you think curators are going to react to your project? Have you gone to see biennial since you've made your own?
Uh-huh.
And the third one is, what are you trying to prove?
Oh, good questions. Oh, and too many at once. Let me process. Okay. Curators? I don't know. It's going to be curious to see because, I have doing it fictionally, it's the easiest job, right? So I'm sure I think I'd be very critical of getting to do it as a fiction. I saw the Last Whitney, and I was like, realized I don't need to be here because it's like blowing my mind, you know, like I need to go, and it'd be nice to go maybe the fall and see the Venice Biennale and enjoy it, because I haven't seen, only saw the Whitney one, because I tried to stay away, and I'd actually try to stay away from a lot of shows because I didn't want to, and be careful of how much I saw. One, I was so busy, but I didn't want to, when you're just being such a sponge, trying to be careful about what I took in.
What are you trying to prove?
What am I trying to prove? Nothing and everything. One thing that makes me excited about this, which I wish I had when I was like a 20-year-old artist, is someone who did something that was so technically big where they tried to do all these different media just to give me permission to try to do something really big on a scale and to use so many different media. And I am not keen on the increasing use of studio assistants by artists to make their work. A lot of painters who don't paint their own paintings anymore. And in many ways, the technical side of this is a statement against that because it's this huge amount of one person's labor. So
is it about craftsmanship?
Craftsmanship's part of it. A lot of it is by bringing the outsiders in and putting them next to conceptual artists. I think there's a big tent. Art is so big, and I hate to see it made into small tents. I think it's just one big tent, and I think it should be treated that way, and it should be talked about that way, and they should be, an outsider artist should be talked in dialogue with, you know. But the top conceptual artist or the top performance artist, and at heart it's all the same, I think. And I say in the catalog that's the mission of Seek, is hunting down what is the power in art, what is the power for a viewer, what is the power for the maker, and what is the power that exists in it as an object. And for me, it was what I was seeking, a quest to get excited about art again, because, when I made it, I was needing enthusiastic rebirth in art, and needing to see, I'm just needing to see a big tent if I had to make it myself, and the conversation be the conversation I wanted to see happening that I wasn't seeing happening. Was that too much to prove?
I think that's a beautiful ending. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Paul.